Next case is United States v. Briggs. Is the appellant ready to argue?
We are.
The government? Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Judge Stuckey, may it please the court. I'm Steve Vladek, and together with my co-counsel, Major Jonathan Legg, Ms. Terry Zimmerman, I represent the appellant, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Briggs. Your Honors, for more than 30 years, the Supreme Court has insisted, as this court reiterated in Mullins, that appellate courts apply the clear law at the time of the appeal, not the time of the trial or even the underlying conduct at issue. Here, that clear law includes this court's decisions in Mangahass and in Lopez de Victoria. Under Mangahass, the statute of limitations for the offense for which appellant was convicted is 5 years. And under Lopez de Victoria, the 2006 amendment to Article 43 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice is not retroactive. Because the statute of limitations therefore provides a complete defense to the sole specification and charge in appellant's case, he's entitled to relief under any standard of review. Therefore, although we believe the proper standard of review in this case is de novo, this court need not decide that and can simply hold that even if plain error is the correct standard of review, there was plain error here. If I may, I'd like to take the specified issues in order, and I'd like to begin with the text of the 2006 amendment, which Your Honors will find at page 141 of the joint appendix. What is critical to the first specified issue is that the text of the 2006 amendment says nary a word about retroactivity. It is silent, as Chief Judge Stuckey described the 2003 amendment to Article 43 in Lopez de Victoria. The other point that I think is critical but not obvious from the text of the 2006 amendment is Congress did not just provide for no statute of limitations for rape offenses. Congress also provided for no statute of limitations for murder offenses, even though prior to the 2006 amendment, non-capital murder, so for example, Article 118.2 or Article 118.3, would have been covered by the 5-year statute of limitations under Article 43B. In other words, Your Honors, Congress actually did, even in that moment in 2006, change the statute of limitations for non-capital murder offenses. And yet there is no indication in the text of the statute, there is no effective date provision, there is nothing in the legislative history that suggests that Congress meant for that change to apply retroactively.
Is that your position with respect to the codification argument?
That's exactly what you just said. The
codification argument, of course, says that Congress doesn't need to do anything if it merely codifies, and you can't apply the presumption if it merely codifies. And the appellant's position is that the fact that it wasn't limited to rape makes it not a codification, makes it more than a codification.
So if I may, Chief Judge Stuckey, we have 2 points, and that's the first one. That the first point is that, yes, the 2006 amendment, in its plain terms, was doing more than merely codifying what Congress believed to be the then judgment status quo. But also, and second, independently of that point, because this court applies the clear law at the time of the appeal, that means the law today. And the law today is that the statute of limitations for rape prior to the 2006 amendment was 5 years. That is to say that Congress, even if it thought at the moment it was passing this amendment that it was simply codifying the status quo, this court doesn't have that luxury because under Mangahass, this court has to treat the 2006 amendment as in fact changing the law. Now, of course, Congress...
Counsel, how does that fit in the case of Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith versus Kern, 92, where the Supreme Court said that in interpreting a statute, a court must, quote, examine Congress's perception of the law that it was shaping a region.
So the Merrill Lynch case is a good example, Judge Olson. I think what is different here is that here we have an intervening change in the law against which we must measure the statute. So if we fast forward to Landgraf, which is a couple of years after Merrill Lynch, when the court is focused on a statute producing a retroactive effect, it does not ask that question as a general proposition. It asks that question as applied to the specific case. And here, the question is whether the 2006 amendment creates a retroactive effect as applied to appellants. Our submission is that because of Mangahass, and because this is a direct appeal where this court is bound to apply Mangahass, the answer is yes.
But in terms of what Congress is, and again, I'm going back to Supreme Court's on statement, must examine Congress's perception of the law. Now, Congress's perception of the law, it could be argued back in 2006, is that there was no limitation. So how do we fit this in with that case?
So I do think, Judge Olson, I do think this would be a harder case if we didn't have non-capital murder alongside the rape amendment. But the government's brief actually repeatedly argues that Congress had no reason to consider applying the 2006 amendment retroactively. That's just not true. That at least with respect to 118.2 and 118.3, there was every reason, if Congress had in fact meant, even under the law as it existed at the time of the 2006 amendment, to apply the statute retroactively, there would have been every reason for Congress to say so. And it's not as if Congress didn't know how to do that. We point out in our reply brief that there are seven different provisions in the very same statute where Congress did expressly apply the 2006 amendment retroactively. And Judge Olson, back to Merrill Lynch, even if Congress thought it was clarifying the law, Congress will still sometimes double up and provide that even in that context, it means for the clarification to be expressly retroactive. So as one example, just 9 months after the 2006 amendment that's at issue here, Congress in the Military Commissions Act of 2006 provided both that it was clarifying the relevant law, that it was not changing the law, and included an effective date provision guaranteeing that its clarification would apply to all cases on, before, or after the date of enactment. So I guess our position is the burden ought to be on the government in this case to show more than just that Congress meant to continue the status quo. The government can't carry that burden. There's nothing in the text, there's nothing in the legislative history, and there's pretty powerful evidence because, again, of non-capital murder that Congress actually didn't mean to apply the amendment retroactively.
What should we make of the fact that the term clarify was used?
So I don't want to sort of devolve too deeply into a semantic debate. I mean, I think clarify is an ambiguous term. But again, it's in the section heading. It's not even in the section heading. Clarify shows up in the legislative history. The text itself doesn't use the word clarify. If you look at page 141 of the joint appendix, the text simply says no limitation for murder or rape. And the section heading, which again is not conclusive but is at least probative, refers to it as an extension of a statute of limitations, not a clarification. So I guess we just think that there's not nearly enough evidence in that language to find the requisite intent to apply this amendment retroactively that this court required in Lopez de Victoria.
That's why I would posit that the inclusion of the word clarifying in issue one is unfortunate because it presupposes the answer to some extent.
Well, I certainly wouldn't put it to this court on how it should present its own issues. I do think that issue one can be resolved without getting into what clarify means. Because under Lopez de Victoria, the question is simply whether the text provides any basis upon which this court can infer the requisite intent to apply the amendment retroactively. We think the answer is no. If I may, I'll turn to issue two. So with regard to the standard of review, we actually do think that, as the Air Force CCA explained in Collins, there's a compelling argument that the standard of review ought to be de novo. And the reason for that is because plain error, as the Supreme Court has made clear, is a standard of review for claims that can be forfeited. Because of RCM 907b2b, which creates an affirmative obligation on the military trial judge to apprise the accused of a statute of limitations defense, as the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals held in McElhaney, it actually can't be forfeit. The only way that an accused can surrender a statute of limitations defense is to waive it.
Counsel, the government, I believe, says that it's a little more subtle than that, that what they're essentially saying is you can't waive that, but it could be forfeited. In other words, this is to prevent any suggestion that something is waived because they didn't raise it. Government, the court has to ask you about it. That doesn't suggest that it can't be forfeited.
So I think that's right, Judge Mavs, with regard to the plain text of RCM 907b2b. The problem for the government is this court's and this court's predecessor's case law interpreting RCM 907b2b. So if we go back, all the way back to Rogers and to Salter and then to this court's decision in Thompson, this court has repeatedly found it to be reversible error, Judge Mavs, without applying plain error review, where the trial judge failed to apprise the accused of a statute of limitations defense under 907b2b. And we read those cases as implying, not holding, but implying, that as a result, as the Air Force CCA held in McElhaney, this is not a defense that can be forfeit. And then, indeed, we actually think that's consistent with how then-Judge Kavanaugh interpreted the similar language of Rule 907 of the Rules for Military Commissions in the Al-Balul case, that these are the kinds of claims that are actually meant to be immune from forfeiture, entirely because we want the burden to be, at least in part, on the trial judge to apprise the accused of potential statute of limitations defenses.
Well, would you agree that given the state of the law at the time of trial in this case, it would have been both futile for the appellant, for the accused, to make an objection and for the military judge to inform him that such an objection was useful?
We certainly agree. I mean, we couldn't disagree with that, Judge Ryan. But, you know, as Your Honor pointed out in your concurring opinion in Harcrow, this is the curious outcome that we see when we try to apply these kinds of issues retroactively.
Right, but it applies to the military judge, but not to the appeal.
Well, I guess the best way to put it is, the question is, what is the law at the time of the appeal? And the law at the time of the appeal is that the statute of limitations was not indefinite. It was 5 years. No one would blame the military judge in this case.
No, and absolutely. My point is slightly different, which is when we're talking about forfeiture versus waiver, how can you forfeit something that would have been futile?
Well, there's also that. I mean, I think that's right. And indeed, I mean, we note in a footnote in our reply brief, there's the added point that in appellant's case specifically, the issue was raised through a motion for leave to file a supplemental assignment of error in the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. And the Air Force Court actually denied it in part on the merits by reference to Willenbrin. So in that context, it seems especially unfair, leaving aside the text of Rule 907b2b and the interpretation of it, to hold the appellant to plain error review. That's why we think there's a compelling case that at least here, the standard review ought to be de novo. And frankly, if the standard review is de novo, this case is, we're done. Because there's a clear Mangahass error, there's a clear Lopez de Victoria problem. Even under plain error review, Your Honors, though, we still think appellant carries his burden because under this court's precedent, for an error to be plain, there's no requirement that there have been a prior precedent clearly recognizing the error. All this court requires is that the error have been obvious. And we believe that given the law at the time of appeal, the error in this case is obvious when you apply Mangahass together with Lopez de Victoria. For all those reasons, Your Honors, we respectfully submit that the charge and specification against the appellant should be dismissed. And if there are no further questions.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Kugler, we represent the United States in this case. The 2006 amendment to Article 43 UCMJ, which states there is no statute of limitations for rape, applies to appellant's 2005 rape offense. Even if the 2006 amendment does not apply, appellant cannot successfully raise a statute of limitations defense for the first time on appeal under the Supreme Court's decision in Musacchio versus the United States. And even if Musacchio does not apply to military cases, the question of which statute of limitations applies to appellant's crime is currently unsettled, meaning the military judge could not have committed plain error in this case. And so to start with issue one, discerning the intent of Congress in passing the 2006 amendment, Congress unmistakably, when we look at the contemporary legal context and legislative history, Congress unmistakably intended that the 2006 amendment apply to rape offenses that occurred before 2006, at least going back to the Willenbrin decision.
Where in the 2006 amendment does it state an intent to make it retroactive?
It doesn't, Judge Ryan, and the government agrees that it does not, but we believe...
But what do you do about Victoria Lopez, which says that it must?
Well, that's not how I interpret Lopez de Victoria. Lopez de Victoria says that there must be some sort of discernible congressional intent, and that indeed it comports with the rest of Supreme Court case law on retroactivity, but it doesn't require a clear statement. You can look at other sources such as statutory construction. You can look at legislative history. And in Lopez de Victoria, there simply was no indication of any type of intent on the part of Congress. But here there is an indication, and we get that from, to start off with, looking at statutory construction. And what happens when Congress, when there's a judicial decision in effect, and Congress amends the law consistent with that particular judicial decision? Because that's exactly what happened in this case.
Counsel, on that point, though, counsel for the appellant points out that it wasn't just for the rape statute, but it also changed the law with respect to certain murder offenses.
And that is absolutely correct, Your Honor. However, what I would say is that certainly there's no indication that Congress intended, for example, non-capital murder to apply retroactively. So it would not be correct to apply this new statute of limitations retroactively in this case. But
how does that support your position? If you've got Congress in the same amendment, also dealing with non-capital murder, so you're dealing with murder, only 5-year statute of limitations. Congress is saying, we're lifting that limitation. And yet, Congress does not affirmatively state that it should be retroactive. What should cause this court to believe that sexual assault was being, or the rape was being, somehow held to a favored status than murder?
Well, because there are really only two interpretations of what Congress could have intended for pre-2006 rape offenses or pre-amendment rape offenses. They could have either intended to continue the status quo and continue to have an unlimited statute of limitations for rape, or they could have intended to go back and say, we don't like Willenbring, we thought Willenbring was the wrong decision, and so we are effectively going to override Willenbring and reinstate a 5-year statute of limitations for rape. And they didn't do that. And if we look at what the Supreme Court has said, for example...
I think there's a third interpretation, which is that we'll pretend that they were aware of Willenbring, and they said, oh my goodness, you know, this is a problem. And so they changed it. Right? Someone raised the question, and so they said, wow, this needs fixing. Without opining whether our court got it right or wrong, just that, like, it doesn't say anything about the statute of limitations for rape. So now we're going to say something, and we think it should be X.
Well, I think what the Supreme Court tells us about the presumptions that we are supposed to apply is that
we're supposed to be in favor of statutes of repose, right? So the presumption should be in favor of first position, not the second.
Well, Your Honor, but the Supreme Court has also said that statutes of repose are not supposed to be applied when congressional intent is clear.
Well, and where is congressional intent at all clear here, other than pointing the other direction?
Well, because, Your Honor, I think, for example, in Mid-Atlantic National Bank, the Supreme Court said, if there is an existing judicial interpretation and Congress intends for legislation to change that existing judicial interpretation, it needs to make that intent clear.
And they didn't change it. They comported with it.
Well, so, but Your Honor, the point is, if they had wanted to change and go back to a 5-year statute of limitations for rape and overcome what the Willenbring decision, they would need to say that.
But Willenbring had an unlimited statute of limitations.
Correct. And so
what
they
did is they changed to comport with Willenbring.
Exactly. And so, but that is how.
Change means it was 5 years and then they changed it.
I mean, no, Your Honor.
Prospectively.
No, I would disagree with that.
But I think that your argument in terms of congressional intent hangs on a fairly tenuous thread.
Well, but I think the opposite would be that they wanted a 5-year statute of limitations, and it's very clear that they did not want a 5-year statute of limitations because they had 8 years since the Willenbring decision.
The question is, what did they want retrospectively, or did they think about it? They gave no indication, number one, that they thought about it. And Congress is generally presumed to legislate prospectively unless it gives a pretty clear indication that it's not. And there's absolutely no indication in the body of this statute or in the report language, which the Armed Services Committee, frankly, takes a lot of care with, that they intended it to be other than prospective.
Well, Your Honor, I would draw this Court's attention, for example, to a companion case to Landgraf, which is Rivers versus Roadway Express, is not cited in the briefs. It's 511 U.S. 289, and it says, even when Congress intends to supersede a rule of law embodied in one of our decisions with what it views as a better rule of law established in earlier decisions, its intent to reach conduct preceding the corrective amendment must clearly appear. So what that's saying, again, is if Congress in the 2006 amendment intended to override what Will and Bring says and impose that five-year statute of limitations on pre-2006 conduct,
Congress didn't have to do anything. Will and Bring was the law, and Mangahas was a knit in somebody's eye floating out there. But you're acting like Congress intended in 2006 to get rid of Mangahas, which is total nonsense.
No, I don't think that, because Congress couldn't foresee
it. Congress generally legislates prospectively, and there's no reason to assume that they didn't do that here.
I just don't understand. I don't understand why the analysis is very simply this, which is, prior to 2006, there was a five-year statute. That there was those cases that had no statute of limitations, and every other case there was a five-year statute of limitations. Then in 2006, they said, we're going to add these other cases, these specific cases, to ones where there will be no statute of limitations. Right? And there's nothing to do with like a five-year statute of limitations for this case or a change. It has to do with they decided that these specific offenses, which weren't just rape, are now going to have an unlimited statute of limitations. And so that's what they put in there. It has nothing to do with whatever the case was, not Mangaha.
Well, Your Honor,
They didn't mention Will and Bring, they didn't mention anything, right? They just said this is the new statute.
Well, Your Honor, they did order in the previous year's NDAA a report from the Department of Defense on revisions to the UCMJ, and that report that they ordered from the DOD came back and said that you should clarify that Will and Bring is good law. And then in the legislative history, the House report and the Committee of Conference reports, they said that's what they were doing, is they were clarifying that there was no statute of limitations for rape. So that's at least some indication. It's in legislative history. It's not actually in the statute, but it is some indication.
Even if that's, and again, clarifying is such an amorphous word, but even if they were clarifying, not making it retroactive.
Well, Your Honor.
Clear statement of retroactivity.
Your Honor, I think we have to ask, if we look at this, if we look at their intent in passing the 2006 amendment, what was Congress intent, if we frame the question this way, what was Congress intending for the statute of limitations to be for rape offenses that occurred in 2005? I think that we have to answer that question they intended there to be no statute of limitations for rape, because if they had intended otherwise, they would have overridden Will and Bring and changed the law.
Well, they could have intended whatever they wanted in 2005, but the problem is it didn't account for COCO, right? And so whatever they intended in 2005, they were wrong, okay? And so that's another problem they have. Like, even if that's what they intended in 2005, it doesn't work for the reasons that they set forth in Mena. So I don't understand the point.
Well, I would also say that we have to look at what the Supreme Court has said the purpose is of requiring this congressional intent. And they say that the purpose of requiring this congressional intent is to ensure that if Congress applies laws retroactively, they have considered the possibilities of disruption and the possibilities of unfairness of applying law. And those concerns simply are not here. There isn't...
Because of the unfairness is why they have to make some sort of a clear and obvious statement that they're making it retroactive.
That's right, Your Honor.
Not that they're clarifying, not that they're changing, but that they're making it retroactive. And all the things you've mentioned don't do that.
Well, but I think what I'm saying is that there was not any potential unfairness here because the law was, they weren't actually changing the law with respect to 2005 offenses, Your Honor. There was no change in the status quo, so there was no potential disruption, there was no potential unfairness, and so requiring something more than what we have really isn't going to serve the purpose of requiring congressional intent. And I think
if we look at the state of the law today, right, they were changing.
Well,
state of the law today, the state of the law in 2005 was that there was a 5-year statute of limitations for rape. So for you to suggest that by changing it to an unlimited statute of limitations in 2006 that there's no unfairness,
well,
how do you possibly make that argument?
Well, and I would point this court to the Daubert case where they conducted an ex post facto analysis, and they did not apply the law at the time of the trial, or I'm sorry, they didn't apply the law at the time of appeal for the purpose of determining whether or not something was ex post facto. They instead applied the law that was in effect at the time the individual committed his crime. And so I think that that's an indication when we're looking at these retroactivity questions and we're looking at ex post facto, the law that we look at for deciding that is the law that was in effect at the time someone committed their crime. And
right,
so,
and the law in effect at the time that this person committed the offense, it was a 5-year statute of limitations.
Well, but again, but that's not the way the Supreme Court analyzed the issue in Daubert. They said that Daubert, for example, was on fair notice that he might receive the death penalty because there was a statute in effect, even though at the time of appeal, that particular statute had been overturned. And we believe that's analogous to the situation that we have here. And so, therefore, when we're looking at these retroactivity questions, we can look at Willenbring to determine whether or not appellant was on fair notice of what the statute of limitations was going to be when he committed his crime.
Counsel, can we change gears and talk about the Musacchio case?
Yes.
I believe it's the government's position that Musacchio just prevents any review of the statute of limitations on appeal if it wasn't raised below.
Yes.
But I believe it's the appellant's view that the issue is sort of automatically in the case, given that the rules for court-martial require the military judge to call the statute of limitations to the attention of the accused. What's the government's response to that?
Well, the government's response is that nothing about 907 requires that the military judge plead the statute of limitations on behalf of the accused, and nothing requires that the military judge automatically dismiss the case on behalf of the accused. And so that onus still remains on the accused, and that is most appropriately reviewed if the accused does not raise it, it's most appropriately reviewed for forfeiture and then plain error, and then Musacchio.
Why?
Applies. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why?
Why is
why plain
forfeiture?
Error?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there are similar examples where even the in the Supreme Court, in federal court, in even this court, where even though the military judge has an affirmative obligation to do something, the accused, if he still does not either object or raise something on his own, then they evaluate for
so
plain error.
The accused has to pull the trigger.
Yes.
The judge can sit mum and not do what the rule absolutely tells him to do. But if the accused sits mum, tough.
Right, that's the Vaughn, the Supreme Court, the Vaughn case.
But what about the series of cases from this court based on Supreme Court precedent that when an accused making an objection would be basically futile based on the status of the law at the time of trial, we don't consider it to be waiver or forfeiture, and we don't use plain error?
Well, I think
that the failure to object when the law is clearly settled in the other direction does not constitute waiver.
Well, Your Honor, I believe if we're looking at, for example, Harcrow and Sweeney in those cases, they said it would have been futile to object, but the court did apply a plain error review in those cases. So I know that appellant brought up these older 907 cases where it does seem as if they just applied a de novo standard of review, but I would like to point out that all of those cases, including Thompson, which was the most recent in 2004, those were all decided before United States versus Gladue, which was a 2009 case, where this court really recognized that in the past the courts had been mixing up waiver and forfeiture and not necessarily applying them correctly. So I think we have to take those older cases with a grain of salt and look here, but I believe that this court and other courts have consistently said that when an accused does not raise an issue at trial, then at the very least forfeiture is applied. And that is appropriate in this case because 907 does not, it's very important to consider that 907 does not remove the onus from the accused from injecting this defense into trial. And so I'm not aware of any case that goes strictly from you didn't waive it to
under plain error. How do you win? I mean, because we look at the law at the time of appeal, right, to determine whether the military judge's failure to interpose the statute of limitations defense was plain and obvious, right? And based on the law today, it was, right? And, right, so there was error. It was plain and obvious. And obviously, if the law today had applied then, it was prejudicial because the case would have been dismissed.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, we would say that that would be to assume that Musacchio doesn't apply. We do believe Musacchio applies, and what Musacchio says is that there cannot be plain error when the onus is on the accused to put the defense at issue and to actually raise the defense. But assuming
Musacchio doesn't assume that there was a change in the law. Musacchio doesn't say, oh, and by the way, even if the statute of limitations was clearly X, you nonetheless need to complain about it.
Well, Your Honor, but I would point this court to other analogous cases from the Supreme Court and the federal courts that have said that just because a law changes, that does not necessarily undo or undermine the choices that an accused made. And certainly a choice an accused might make is whether or not to plead the statute of limitations at trial. And so, for example, the Brady case from the Supreme Court and Lockett and Morrison, they deal, for example, with waiving appellate rights or a guilty plea. And those are all choices that are made, just like the choice would be made to raise the statute of limitations in this case. And they don't.
The choice was, he didn't raise the statute of limitations because we hadn't decided the case.
Correct, Your Honor, but that's exactly the point that the Supreme Court was making in Brady. They don't necessarily get the benefit because the law changes.
Well, yeah, but they don't necessarily get screwed because the law changes. Go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, what I would say is that the statute of limitations is a defense. It is basically giving someone a pass on guilt because it doesn't care whether or not the statute of limitations does not concern.
Yes, counsel, it's a pass on guilt, I suppose, if we assume that everyone who ever pleads it would be capable of being proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, which I think is a very large assumption. But statutes of limitation exist for a reason, and that reason is repose. Repose in the judicial system. Repose politically, repose in society. There's a reason for them. I mean, it's not just a pay. It's not just, pass, go, and collect $200.
Your Honor, I see my time is up. May I briefly respond?
Sure.
Your Honor, what I would just say is because the statute of limitation, or because the statute of limitations is something that does not consider whether or not the accused is actually guilty, that is a reason why Congress has said and the courts have interpreted that it is a defense that must be raised by appellant, and it's appropriate to apply plain error if it is not raised, or it is appropriate to apply plain error, and in the cases of Musacchio, find that there could not have been error and that the issue cannot be raised on appeal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Chief Judge Stuckey, may it please the court. Very briefly, I just want to say a couple of words about the standard of review. Obviously, this court need not decide that de novo is the appropriate standard of review if it believes that the appellant can carry the plain error standard here. And, of course, we would be happy either way. I just want to say briefly on the forfeiture point, it's worth stressing that there's more than just these old cases from this court's predecessor, the Salter case, the Rogers case, even this court's ruling in Thompson. I mean, there's a consistent line of cases under Rule 907 and as interpreted especially by the courts of criminal appeals. In our briefs, we cite to decisions by both the Army and Air Force CCAs that expressly hold that forfeiture doesn't apply to a 907B2B error. And so we don't think it's nearly as anachronistic as the government suggests. And finally, perhaps most importantly, Your Honors, to us the critical difference between this case and Musacchio is the nature of the military justice system and the simple fact that the president is allowed to confer more rights upon service members as compared to criminal defendants in the civilian criminal justice system. We think the only way to read Rule 907B2B, which is in marked contrast to statutes of limitations defenses in the civilian criminal justice system, is as the president choosing, for better or for worse, to confer more rights upon defendants in this context. We think this case is a textbook example of how that ought to work. If there are no further questions, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:45.
Court stands in recess until 10:45.